Okay, so this is the last part of our course, Follow the Leader. And we're going to look at the final two principles, which will take us to six, because it was two each week we were doing. And today we'll do principle five and principle six when it comes to leadership. And as we described already a number of times, leadership doesn't always just mean I'm leading a company, I'm leading loads of people. It could be leading a small group, could be leading a family, definitely leading a family, actually. Right? We become leaders of our own children, leadership of a community, of life in general. But it can apply anywhere. And the idea was Jewish leadership was the idea. And that doesn't just mean Jewish leaders. And we've been looking mostly at Jewish leaders, obviously. But there are certain principles that we get from Judaism, and we can see from leaders. And we're going to go through a number of people today. So let's do principle number five. Let's jump straight in. So what's principle number five? So principle number five is leadership means believing in the people you lead. Now that might seem pretty obvious, right? Because you've got to believe in them. But not always. Many times people will lead others and they don't believe in them. And their belief will be that we have to control them. We have to tell them what to do, and it becomes a dictatorship as opposed to a relationship. And we're looking for relationships here, aren't we? That's what we want in life. So, funnily enough, Moshe Rabbeinu, had a bit of a challenge at one point where he wasn't so believing in the people. And leading with Jews is not always so easy. Let's have a look at what happened over here. This incident and the message that he got, which is for all of us as well, obviously. And it says in the book of Shemot, Hashem said, I have seen the affliction of my people that are in Egypt, and I have heard its outcry. This is basically Moshe Rabbeinu before he went in to get the Jewish people out of Egypt. And he says, I'm going to descend to rescue them from the hand of Egypt. Now go, and I'll send you to Pharaoh. So that, remember, that was the whole let my people go thing, you know. And he was told to go and gather the elders of Israel and say to them, Hashem, the God of your forefathers has appeared to me, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right, a little bit of context. I shall bring you up from the affliction of Egypt to a land flowing with milk and
money.
Oh, that's right. Honey. Sorry, I made a mistake. That's right. Moses responded and said, but they're not going to believe me. You're telling me to go to Pharaoh. You're telling me to go to the Jewish people and tell them, okay, it's been a couple hundred years. We've been slaves. We're out of here. He's like, what are you talking about? They're not going to believe me. They're not going to listen to my voice. And they'll say, Hashem didn't appear to you. They're going to believe that you sent me. They're going to believe I'm just like a just some guy who just turned up out of nowhere. They know me, they know the family, they know my brother and sister. I'm going to turn up out of nowhere. So God said to him, no problem. I'm going to give you certain signs. Certain signs that you're going to show them, and by showing them these signs, they're going to believe you. So what are the three signs he was told to show? So first of all, his staff, and this actually happened when he was by himself, his staff turned into a snake, number one. Number two, he was told to put his hand in his jacket. It came out, and it came out with sarasa, leprosy. And finally, the water in the river will be poured into dry land and become blood. Those were the signs. So the commentators work out and say, why was he shown those three particular signs? He's like, show them to the people. By the way, he didn't actually end up doing this. So there were more signs for him than not for him. So it's like this. See, the first two signs actually were a message to him. People don't realize this when they see the text, but it's in context. And that is number one, snake. What message was being sent to Moses by being shown a snake? And that was, remember the snake in the Garden of Eden? Remember that snake? What happened with that snake? It spoke slanderous about Adam and Eve. Two, his hand became leprosy, tsaras. When did that happen? That was a sign that a person was speaking bad of others. And basically, it's the result of when a person had tsaras, they would be separated from the community in order to be cured of it. So say the commentators, you know what? Moses was punished. He spoke badly about the people. He didn't believe that they would believe in him. And for that, he was given these two punches, these two smacks. And that was the message that God was telling Moses, that you know what? You can't talk bad of the people, you've got to believe in them. They make mistakes, and they made a lot of mistakes. We'll see in a moment how many mistakes they actually made and the result of it, but you can't talk about it. You can't talk about it, and you can't, and you've got to believe in the people. You've got to believe they have potential to do great things. This is very good, actually, when it comes to, I know none of you are there at this point, but you will be, God willing, when it comes to bringing up kids. Kids have very, very different abilities, and you'll see from day one, literally day one, sometimes hour one, how different they are. Me, you know, I thought, yeah, well, kids are all born the same, all come out the same. And they all come out crying and screaming, you know, and kvetching, and then and that's it. And that's it. No. All kids are different, right? One of my kids came out screaming, shouting. She still is 13 years later. The other one came out straight to sleep, right? Okay? She's still asleep. You know, it's like every child comes out differently. And the key to parenting, not that I've mastered it in any way, shape, or form, but they say one of the keys is you've got to believe that the abilities that they have is for them. They have to bring them up according to their abilities. You've got to kind of figure out what's right. How do you educate each child according to their ability? Because kids are not the same. And they have to be spoken to, reacted to, and sometimes it seems different. One kid you're punishing tough, and one you're being soft on, because, and the kid's like, hey, it's not fair. How come she got to do that? And how come he gets to get away with that? And it's like, well, they're different. It's different. You've got, when you lead, you've got to kind of find the right balance for the right child in the right way. It's a balancing act, but it's very, very different. But you've got to believe in their talents, because each one of them has very unique talents, as we all do. As we all do. We're not all the same. And one of the problems with the educational system here in the Western world, specifically, actually, is that they grade everyone in the same kind of system. Which I know is a big debate right now, bringing up kids, educating them, but that's not for now. Anyway, well, why should it be? Why should it be we believe in people? Maybe people are idiots. Could be. Maybe, you know what? Don't believe in them. People are bad and you shouldn't believe in them, and who cares? And who knows where they're going to end up? And the answer is we do believe in people, and we believe the best in people. And it's based upon an idea which you've never mentioned before, but I'll show you right now. And when humans are created, God said, let us make man in our likeness. They shall rule over the fish, the seas, the birds of the sky, over the animals, the whole earth. We humans are given responsibility over the planet, which is a whole talk in of itself. But we humans were given responsibility to take care of this physical world, to use it for our own good, okay, but also for the good of itself. So it says, God created man in his image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. So we are made in the image of God. Now there's many, many commentators trying to figure out what that means. Says the Rambam, Maimonides, what do you mean made in the image of God? God has no physical image. Right? One of the principles of Judaism is God is not physical in any way, shape, or form. So what does image of God mean? So the Rambam says, I'll tell you what it means. It says that among all of God's creatures, only we humans, unlike the animal kingdom and obviously the plant kingdom, we have this ability to be moral, reasoning beings. We have that ability. We have the ability to think and make moral decisions based upon our own intellect. We have that ability. We have societies that may lead us astray, but ultimately, we have the power to make good ethical and moral decisions. And it reminds me, actually, there's a Talmudic piece that says the following. It says, let's say that God wouldn't have communicated with us. God communicates with us, God leads us, but let's say God would not have communicated with us. Right, there would be no Torah, no Judaism. We'd just be left alone. How would we know to do good or bad things? What would be the system? Any ideas? It says the following. It says that even if God had not revealed himself to us and given us the Torah, we could look at animals. You could look at ants and learn organization. You could look at cats and learn cleanliness. You look at dogs and learn loyalty. Look at various creatures that are in the world, and they will teach you how to live. So what's the question on that piece of Talmud? Right, learning from the animal kingdom. Maybe you'll learn the wrong trait from the wrong animal. You'll learn how to be clean from a dog, right? You'll learn how to, I don't know, respect from a vulture. I don't know. You can learn out the wrong thing from the wrong animal. It's a fair question. And they say, Instinctively, we know what to do. Deep down inside us, we instinctively have the ability to know what is the right thing to do. Sometimes we have societies and people who will smother that innate knowledge. But every so often we're going to stop and reflect. And inside, people know the right thing to do. Which means the natural state of humans, made in the image of God, is to do the right thing. That is the natural state. It's hard to believe if you look at world history. But for the majority of people out there, you know what's right and you know what's wrong. That's your inner being. That's who you are. You're not born a clean slate. You're born with a soul and you have the ability to discern good from bad because you're made in the image of God. Make sense? Yeah. So trust in people. So let's have a look at some people from Jewish history who we see had this ability. So King David. King David is one of the people who was considered to be one of the great Jewish leaders. We've not spoken about him much, but let's talk about him now. So King David had this ability to know people and trust them very, very intrinsically. And trust their negative attributes as well. Let's have a look at one story. So there was a descendant of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, who became a thief. Was very into money and stealing. And he became an idol worshipper. Which is one of Moses' descendants. So what they did with him, and his name was Jonathan. And he saw, King David, that this guy had a big desire for money. He had a big desire and ended up like getting involved in shady practices. So what would most people think? It's like, this guy's bad news. I don't care who his ancestors were. He's bad. Get him out of here. That's probably what most of us would do. But King David did something very interesting. He said, you know what? He's got this desire for bad. So let's try to use that same desire for the good. Channel, like we said with kids, channel that desire for the good. So what he did was, he made him the head of the temple's treasury. He basically made him a bank manager. That's what he did. Made him a bank manager. And it was a big risk and a big gamble. I'm sure many, many people told him, this is a really bad idea. But he said, no. I think this ability he has, and this is not a unique story, can be channeled for the good. And eventually this guy became one of the great people. His name has changed to Shvuel. It was when Shavuel, he came back to God. And he used this desire for money to kind of take care of a lot of money, you know. And he ended up being known as a very, very righteous person who maybe earlier on in his life, he was not a good person. But people can change if you believe in them. If you believe in someone, even though they make terrible mistakes, people can change. Okay, so David had the ability to look a little bit deeper, see in this person a bad trait. But if we can channel that, if we can take that bad trait and move it to the good, it can become incredible. You know? There's one of the most famous converts to Judaism. Probably most of you have never heard of her. But actually, we learn out a lot of the laws of Jewish conversion from this woman. Anyone know what her name was? Ruth. Ruth was her name. And she was not Jewish. She was a Moabite from Moab, a nation next to Israel. And in the book of Ruth, where actually we learn a lot of the laws of how to convert, what's needed to convert. And we'll look actually some very famous verses over here. So there was someone called Elimelech, who's a very, very wealthy individual. And there was a famine in Israel. This is after the Jewish people entered into Israel, time of the judges. And Elimelech left Israel because people started to beg him for money, because he was wealthy. And he left Israel because he didn't want to support the Jewish people. He said, if I stay in Israel, I'm going to lose all my money. And I've worked very, very hard. So he left Israel and went to live abroad. And he went with his wife and the two sons. Eventually he died. And he left a widow by the name of Naomi. Are you following? Okay. So we have Elimelech, his wife Naomi, very wealthy, they're in Israel, hey guys, and they leave Israel during a time of famine because they want to keep their money. Eventually they become very impoverished living abroad. They start to lose their money with his death first of all. And he has two sons that marry two non-Jewish women. One is called Orpah, which by the way I think Oprah was meant to be named after, but they messed up the name, seriously. Orpah. And the other was called Ruth. Ruth in English. Okay? So their two sons marry these two daughters. Then the two sons die. So now you have this woman, Naomi, stuck in a foreign land. She was extremely wealthy, one of the probably wealthiest people in Israel at the time. She becomes very, very poor. And she's left supporting two daughter-in-laws because her sons die. So she's left with them. Eventually says, you know what, it's not good. I'm going back to Israel. Maybe I'll try to get myself back up in Israel. So the two daughter-in-laws, watch very carefully. We learn out conversion from these verses. Follow inside. We're going to read this book, actually, in Shavuot in a couple of weeks. It says that Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and left. When she knew she was leaving, they were very, very close. But Ruth cleaved to her, and Naomi said, no, go home. She pushed her away. And she says, no, I want to come with you. Probably all these details become significant in Jewish law. And she said, very famous verse, wherever you go, I'm going to go. Wherever you live, I'm going to live. Your nation, that's my nation. Your God, that's my God. Wherever you die, I'm going to die. And they went to Bethlehem, and that's where they lived. Okay? So interesting, they learn from here when a person wants to convert, you should push them away a little bit. But when they do end up converting, they don't just like kind of take on cultural aspects. Wherever you live, I live. Where you die, I die. Whatever you do, I do. You've got to fully, a real convert, like Ruth, really becomes part of the community. It's not just a, superficial reality. They learn that from Ruth. And they say that you shouldn't have to go with. Naomi said, you're fine as you are. You can stay where you want to be, which is how we view converts. You don't have to become Jewish. You're fine as you are. All right? We don't go knocking on doors for converts, yeah?
Why do we read the book of Ruth on Shavuot?
Good question. Why do we read the book of Ruth on Shavuot, the holiday that celebrates the giving of the Torah? Yeah. I'll give you one quick answer. There's many, many answers to that question. One is for the reason we're saying over here, and that is the Jewish people all converted at Mount Sinai to become a nation. So we go back and we look at this story of this non-Jew who did convert. We're like, wow, that's what we want to be like. We look at her as the example. You know, we get inspired. You ever get inspired by the stories of non-Jews become Jewish? Anyone heard these stories of like converts? You're like, why? You know, it's like, how? I'll be honest with you. I've been involved with many, many converts over the years. Many. I've never heard a good reason why a person would become Jewish. Go to any convert, a real convert. You know, who like came back. Because tell me, why do you become Jewish? You'll always get the most like I just like it. You know, smart people. People who chose great professions, you know, and it was just the right thing to do. Truth is, there's no logical reason. I've never, ever heard a good reason why they've become Jewish. It's always like, you know, something like emotional.
Marriage.
Okay. Marriage? Why they get married?
No. They convert to get married.
Oh, he was saying. We'll discuss that another time. Not for now. It's possible, but it still has to come from themselves. They have to want to do it. It's not sufficient to do it for somebody else. Because when that somebody else disappears, then... I'll tell you a story, actually. I just told this recently. A girl came to see me who wants to convert, actually. So she came to see me. And she's dating a Jewish guy. So I told her something which I've seen a few times. Sometimes the girl gets involved because of a guy, or vice versa. But usually the girl for the guy, because that's usually the way, you know, it works. So I told her, I said, you know what sometimes happens? Sometimes the girl gets involved with somebody else, which happens, and they start learning, and they start studying, and then they become more into being Jewish than the person they're dating, so they dump them and become Jewish. That happens. It makes sense. Think about it. It makes sense, right? It makes sense. Why does it make sense? Because he's dating someone who's not involved at all. He wants to become Jewish because whatever, you know, his guilt or something. He wants to marry someone Jewish. So he like puts her through the course, but she sometimes will take to it and love it and really enjoy it, which makes sense. And she ends up being like, what am I doing with this guy? She dumps him and then... That's happened more than once in my experience. I wouldn't say it's common, but it's happened more than once. So it's possible. It's possible. It could be still be a motivator. I'm not saying it's not. Okay? Anyway, so they go back. So Ruth obviously goes with her, and they're very poor people. And she says, who is this woman? Everyone's asking, who is this woman who's like walking into town? And she's a Moabite, she became Jewish, her name is Ruth, and this is Naomi, the wealthy woman. Look what happened to her. She's so poor, she's so Nebuch. I'm going to stand, I can't see people. She's so poor, she's so Nebuch, and they felt terrible for her. What happens to Ruth? Do you know what happens to her? She ends up marrying someone for a very short amount of time by the name of Boaz. Boaz was the spiritual leader of the generation. So he takes in, and what happens? Boaz marries her, and do you know who their descendants are? King David. Kingship comes from Ruth. King David is a direct descendant from his maternal side of a convert. No problem. To be a king, it comes through the father's side, which Boaz qualifies for. But Boaz married someone who converted, so it still works. You follow? So one second. There's no one else to marry out there? There's no one else? They're like, go to the synagogue, find the rabbi's daughter and marry her. What's he doing? So they say, and this again, this is a common theme. I'll give you one more example, just so you understand it. He saw in this convert incredible potential and greatness. He knew intrinsically somehow that although she's this poor woman who just arrived from Moab, just converted, married from her, great things are going to come. And he was right. He married her, and they had his descendants. And from them, the whole King David, which ends up being Mashiach by the end of days, comes through this convert. There was a bandit, a very famous bandit, basically highway robber, called Reish Lakish. Shimon ben Lakish was his name. But they referred to him as Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So he was a criminal. A bandit, he would basically a highway robber. And the story is told in the Torah, a very famous story, that he was walking along a river and he saw a beautiful woman in the river. So he saw a nice opportunity. He jumps in a great distance, had tremendous power and strength, and he jumps and lands right next to her. Happens to be the woman is not a woman. The woman is a man by the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan is considered to be one of the great Talmudic scholars of Jewish history. Rabbi Yochanan, you follow, you study Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan says that. Happens to be he was a very handsome man, very beautiful person, and he's there in the water, and Reish Lakish is on the bank, and he mistakes him for a woman. So he jumps in to hit on this woman, ends up being a fella. And Rabbi Yochanan looks at him and says, wow, you're a tough guy. He's like, yeah, I'm a highway robber. And he says, your strength can be used for greatness. You could be an incredible person. And he says, your beauty could be for a woman. I.e., so what? You know what I'm saying? What do you do with it? He says, I'll make a deal with you. If you turn your life around right now, if you turn it around, I'm going to introduce you to my sister, and if she agrees, you can marry her. Basically, the chief rabbi turns around to a bandit, a criminal, who just hit on him, thinking he's a woman, and says, you know what? You can marry my sister if you turn. Reish Lakish says, you got yourself a deal. She's as pretty as you. I'm in. I'm in. At that point, by the way, yeah, don't worry, Mike. You're not going to give your sister away that easily. Don't worry. We're going to make sure he vets people before he even thinks about saying someone up. I wouldn't trust him either. Don't worry. Says the Talmud that Reish Lakish, Shimon ben Lakish, actually at that point, it's interesting, he became very weakened at that point. He couldn't get out of the water, but the whole discussion why, and what accepting upon yourself responsibility does for you, and power and leadership, but we'll leave that aside. He ends up not following in his bad ways. He becomes a Torah scholar, the leader of the generation. And if you look through the Talmud, you see Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish teaching and teaching and teaching and teaching. So the question is, Rabbi Yochanan, are you crazy? Is no one better to set up your family as your sister? Right? Is that what you want to set up a date with your sister with? Right? Boys and their sisters, very, very protective, right? They're like, you know, they'll break kneecaps. And you're like, oh, Mises bad, he's in the war, right? He's like, oh, don't worry. How can it be? It's the same theme. King David, Moses, Boaz, Ruth, they see tremendous potential in people and are willing to risk. I won't say risk. These are calculated choices based upon believing in people that they have greatness. There are many, many more stories. I think of personal stories of people I know who I look back at their lives, I was like, wow. I mean, I don't know if you ever do it, but you go back to high school. You ever look back at high school? I'm fascinated. You look back at some of the people, you're like, this person's going to become the leader. And you look, and you're like, wow, I'm shocked at how. And then some people who are complete bums become great. I think at some point someone believed in them. I don't know, I can't say for sure. But it's like maybe in your lives too. You know, someone believed in you, felt you had the potential to do great things, although maybe at that point you were deserving of it. I know I've had that in my life. And you become great. Right? You got to look a bit deeper. You got to look a bit deeper. It's not always so easy. Okay? Okay, that was number five. Believe in people. Number six. Leadership involves a sense of timing and pace. Timing and pace. So what does that mean? So there's an interesting verse where God appointed Moses to become a leader. And it goes like this. Follow inside. Numbers. May the Lord, the God who gives breath to all living things, appoint someone over his community to go out before them and come before them, who will lead them out and bring them in. Okay. So this is like the verse that describes the great leadership quality. But there's a repetition. I'll say it again just so you pick up on it. Those that don't have the sheets. I want to have someone who's going to watch over the people who go out before them, go out before them, and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in. So it's a repetition, apparent repetition. So Moses is saying two things about leadership that we have to know. Through this repetition, we can learn it out. A leader must lead from the front. You see, many, many great commanders and generals, the best ones, they say, weren't leading from some ivory tower, some fortress. They were out up front. Like King David, for God, very famous of always being the first in battle. Moses was always involved in the battle, literally the physical battle. He was always there. When he wasn't strong enough, he still put himself on the field so that people could see. People could see him. Right? Miriam was always up front, putting herself in front of the community. People could see them. So they went out before them. Okay? But a leader must not be so far out in front that when we turn around, that when the leader turns around, they can't see anyone following them. So you've got to put yourself in front, but not too far in front, that the people behind you can't grasp you and see you and learn from you. They have to lead them out, meaning they have to carry people with them, and they've got to be at a pace that people can follow them. So be out, but you've got to be in. You hear? One of the greatest challenges that Moses, who's still one of the greatest Jewish leaders of Jewish history, obviously, had, and his deep frustration was he wanted people to change, and we all struggle with this, and you want it so much, and you want them to become better people and be nicer and be, but he just couldn't do it. He tried and he pushed and he complained and he threatened and he bribed and you do everything you can to try to get someone to change. And one of the deep frustrations that we all have, which Moses had as well with the people, is that people don't change. And you've got to kind of go with the pace. Moses wanted to take the Jewish people from Mount Sinai straight to Israel. But they weren't ready, had to wait 40 years. 40 years in order to change that entire generation so that their kids could actually get into the land of Israel. Right? That sounded like, for Moses, that was 40 years too long. Okay? And that's one of the classic statements, that your job is not to complete the task, but you can't not get involved in it. Right? You've got to pace it. That's what I mean. You've got to pace the change. You've got to see some kids change quick, and sometimes you've got to learn homework with your kids 101 times and drives you absolutely crazy. Sometimes you're at work and there's people you work with, it's like, it's so simple. Why can't you get it? I've told you 100 times how to do it. Why are they still screwing up? It doesn't make sense. There's a certain amount of, you can't put yourself so far ahead. You've got to pull yourself back. The greatest educators are those who are able to pace themselves and be ahead, but not too far ahead. Right? Expect, but not expect too much from the people they are leading. So it's a delicate balance. And I don't know the answer to this. It's like, you've got to be impatient, but still patient. Right? Not too fast. You go too fast, the people rebel, and they can't handle it. You know? It takes time. And it takes time. Transformation. You know, King David wanted more than anything else to build the temple. That was his big thing, right? He put the foundations in. He was a great leader. He was a great general. He was very holy and very learned and wrote psalms and all the great things. But he was not allowed to build the temple. Do you know why? Because he fought in wars. Good wars. Wars he was meant to fight in. And he fought the way he was meant to fight. But a person of war was not allowed to build the temple in Jerusalem, because the temple in Jerusalem is a place of peace. The temple in Jerusalem, place of peace. So he wasn't allowed to build. He put the foundations in, and he told his son to do it. And Solomon, who was not a fighter, he was a great thinker, he was allowed to build the temple. So the transformation over here took time more than a single generation. You know, I don't know if you've read this book, but I really recommend it. I tell you, you'll thank me. And there's a book called The Prime Ministers by Yehuda Avner. It's actually made into a movie recently. I tell you what, it's worth reading this book. If you want to understand politics in Israel in a very simple, easy way of what's happened over the past 60 years, read this book. Even the first, like, you know, few chapters will give you a good indication. The Prime Ministers by Yehuda Avner. So I read this book, and I thought I was quite learned about Israeli politics, but you really get to see, you know. So this guy Yehuda Avner was actually English, from Manchester, moved to Israel, became born in politics, became a speechwriter for all of the prime ministers, pretty much, right up to modern times, from the earliest days to the... And he's still alive. He gives speeches. You can find him online, this guy, giving his life story and speeches. Anyway, so one of the prime ministers he was very, very close to was Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin, who was... I mean, maybe I'm biased, but probably one of the greatest prime ministers in Israel. I always say that Bibi Netanyahu, our present prime minister of Israel, bases himself upon Menachem Begin in a lot of ways. That's my opinion. But if you read the book, you may understand a little bit why. So Menachem Begin is considered to be, in the political world in Israel, one of the people who was always in the opposition. He was always on the losing side. He had to wait years and years and years to make it to become prime minister. He was always on the wrong side of history, the wrong time, and the wrong way, you know? And eventually, he got to be the leader. And most people probably said to him, it's never going to happen. But he kept up, and he kept up, and he kept up, and he kept pushing and pushing. And eventually, his time came, like, I don't know, 20 years after entering politics, he got to finally lead Israel, which no one really believed. And he did an incredible job. Yeah. I made a mistake. I've got a seventh principle. It'll take me 5 minutes and we'll get rid of it. Yeah? You ready? Let's do one more. This is a nice way to finish the entire course, I believe. And here's principle number 7. Leaders work on themselves and possess self-control. And it's really, really important. Leaders work on themselves. Yep. So the Kuzari is a book. It's a book written hundreds and hundreds of years ago about a real incident, but it's an imaginary book. There was a small town with a king called the Khazar, the king of Khazar. And this king was not Jewish, and supposedly, according to Jewish tradition, he got together a priest, Christian priest, a Jewish rabbi, and a imam, a Muslim, and had them debate. And he said, whoever wins the debate, I'm going to convert to their religion, my entire kingdom. That's the story.
So eventually, a couple hundred years later, one of the Jewish writers, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, said, you know what, I'm going to make up a story as to what happened in this debate. So he wrote a book, which became a Jewish classic, which you can still read today. You can, I have it at home, in English. They translated it. And it's an imaginary debate between these three people and the king, backwards and forwards. He actually adds a philosopher. Anyway, over there, the Kuzari had a question. So basically, it's a dialogue. This whole book is a dialogue. It's pretty interesting. And the Kuzari said, tell me how the upright and pious people of your religion behave. How do righteous people in your religions behave? So he asked the rabbi, then the priest, and then the imam. He wanted to know, what makes a righteous person? Okay. So the rabbi said, an upright person is one who is concerned with his country. He provides all his citizens with their every provision and need. He leads them justly, does not oppress them, and does not give them any of them more than their rightful share. So the Kuzari said, I asked you about an upright person, not a leader. You told me, I asked you what's a good person, and you told me what a good leader is. And the rabbi said, an upright person is by definition a good leader. That's how you define it. All of his senses, his attributes, his spiritual, physical, all of them come from leadership. If you are a good leader, if you can lead people well, whatever you're doing, then you're a good person. And he brought down verses to prove it. So there's a famous story of King Solomon, and King Solomon was offered to be wise, powerful, or have money. That's what he chose. He was offered one of those three, whatever that means. He was offered a choice, and he chose wisdom. And they say because of his wisdom, because he was wise, he became very powerful and had lots of money. But he chose wisdom. Since a king is basically an agent of God, he's got to be able to discern what people need in situations. Okay, he's got to know what's right for him to do and what's wrong for him to do. So what am I saying? How do you become a good person? By being a good leader. That's it. If you can lead other people well, in family, business, life, that is the litmus test. According to Judaism, we just saw as to being a good person in and of itself. How you treat others is a definition of how you treat, you know, funny, all the great prophets in Jewish history, I mean, the main ones we have, all start off, you know what job they have before they become the great prophets and leaders? Shepherds. They were shepherds. Right? Now you look through the scripture, you're like, well, obviously that's all they were doing. Now they could have been involved in agriculture. They could have been involved in a lot of things. Why were they shepherds? King David was a shepherd. Right? Moses was a shepherd. Abraham was a shepherd. Why are we thought of as shepherds? What's the idea of shepherding? Okay. So they say if they can take care of little creatures and have mercy upon them, there's a better chance they can have mercy and be good to people. They're always given, earlier on in their careers, small creatures to lead over, and if they have empathy towards them, then they're given great positions of leadership. They don't start leading vast amount of people, they start small, humble, taking care of creatures. And the scriptures tell us stories, right? King David is chasing a lost sheep, and because of that, he's chosen to be a leader. Moses at the burning bush, how did he end up over there? Because one of the sheep he was taken care of ends up losing. He's like, I got loads more. He goes after it, and then he gets the burning bush. Those incidents are juxtaposed or put next to each other, not by coincidence, to teach you, take care of the small people, right? Work on your character with the small and leadership potential possibilities, and then you have much greater positions of leadership that are waiting for you. So we're always like waiting for the big job, big opportunity, the big one, and we say, what are we doing right now? That's not really me. That's just like, whatever. I'm going to get through this terrible job situation. I'm going to get through this terrible relationship. I'm going to get through this. But actually, that's there as a mechanism to produce you to become great. It's not coincidence. So, I'll just get through this until I can. But all those experiences are there to propel you and to prepare you and maybe even qualify you to become a great leader. So all those struggles and all those irritations and all the horrible stuff that happens to us, you'll look back and all the nasty experiences, a dating story, you know me. I know a girl who was in a relationship, and something happened to her, which was unusual thing, but it was a terrible thing. Something happened to her during this relationship that was terrible, terrible, terrible thing. Really, really. You know, it just wasn't nice. But, like, and she came in, and she went through, you know, therapy because of it. And she came to see me, and she said, why would God do this to me? Why would God do this to me? I'm like, I don't know, you know. Maybe, at some point in your life, in the future, it'll become clear to you. But right now, I don't know. Maybe at some point, some... End up being, she got through this dark period, and I can't say. And it was just, I mean, there was a certain amount of violence that was projected towards her, let's put it that way, in this relationship. It was not nice, not nice. And, I mean, I didn't know her before this, but happened to be that, I mean, it doesn't sound so unusual to you, but she ended up using that, and she ended up becoming someone who advised other people who went through this experience. I'm not saying it's good to happen to her. If she had a choice, she would have chosen for it not to happen to her. But she became a leader in a certain field of social work, should we say, of therapy. And also that experience. Many times you hear that. Many people go through those experiences. I'm saying, look, it's never good these bad things happen. But they have to be utilized at some point to propel and act as a source of leadership for others. It's a very, very important in her own development in this area. And it doesn't have to be that bad. It could be something small. It could be a frustration you have. But I don't mean, if you work through it, eventually you become a better person. How do you know you've got through it? You start to lead others in it. That becomes the litmus test that this episode did not happen for no reason. We'll stop over there. Thank you, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the 6-part course. And we will pick this up, God willing, next semester after the summer. Enjoy the good weather. Have a great day.